This is In Deep. I'm Angie Caro. I'm spending this whole hour with author Tracy McMillan. She's touring with her new book, The American Way of Eating. She's stocked shelves at Walmart, picked garlics and grapes in California, worked the Applebee's kitchen, and then made nationwide headlines as a Rush Limbaugh target. An hour's conversation with the overeducated Tracy McMillan on In Deep. It's that time again. It's time for our one and only demented sidekick, Buttercup. It's gotta laugh. Half the talent behind thepoliticalcarnival.net. Actually, the big half of the talent at thepoliticalcarnival.net. Laffy, welcome aboard. As always, we are welcoming your particular take on the news of the week.
Well, thank you. I hope I'm not late. I was busy trying to perfect my English so that Rick Santorum won't make me self-deport.
Hey, is this the third week in a row you've brought me a Rick Santorum story?
He's just so full of Santorum stories. This one, it's been around, but, you know, it's worth talking about. This. He went to Puerto Rico and said, speak English if you want statehood. He actually said this. He said, like any other state, there has to be compliance with this and any other federal law. And that is that English has to be the principal language. There are other states with more than one language, such as Hawaii, hint, hint. But to be a state of the United States, English has to be the principal language, which means he hasn't read the Constitution because there's nothing in the Constitution that says that anywhere, which makes me believe he's been homeschooled by Michelle Bachmann.
There should be a law that if you're going to run for president of the United States, you're not allowed to just make stuff up.
Well, then Fox would go broke because all their guests would that would be the end of them. Oh. But yeah, that's his story. And then we've got some, like, not funny ones. I mean, that one wasn't that funny, but it was a little amusing. Mm-hmm. There's a couple here that are just making me nuts. I mean, Twitter went nuts with these. Do you want me to just start with the icky one?
Yeah.
Okay, there's a site that somebody sent me to. There's a guy in Tampa, Florida, that's selling stickers that say things like, don't renege, not reneg, not R-E-N-E-G-E, but R-E-N-I-G. Don't renege in 212. And they have a big caricature of President Obama's face. Ugh. And then they've got Obama 12 with the face of an ape. Mm. And then they have, I've got nothing against Allah. It's his fan club I can't stand. So they're kind of an equal opportunity offender. And, you know, on the heels of the Alexandra Pelosi video of Mississippi residents calling President Obama a half-breed and all this other stuff I've been finding, you know, for years now on the internets, this is just horrible. It's just, you know, with all the hate speech that started when President Obama ran, it just... the first time, I mean, in 2008. It's so disheartening.
But you know what it can be? It really can be a great motivator, because as I always remind people when stuff like this comes up, these people get to vote as often as we do. And if you don't go to the poll, they just might. This is why you vote.
Get off your butts and vote. Absolutely. That and the Supreme Court are my, you know, two major motivators. But then we have a little bit more amusing one, although it still bothers me. It's a site called Bastard Blasters. And when you go onto the site, up pops a window that says a little intro, and then it says, our novelty products, contests, and website are intended for, in big letters, mentally stable and responsible adults with common sense and a sense of humor, in big red letters. If you do not feel that this describes you, or are easily offended, in big letters, our site is probably not for you, and we politely ask that you visit a different site. And the reason they have this big stupid disclaimer is because they're a nonpartisan bunch of people that
What were you going to say, really?
I ain't going to say. They offer this product that are, they're these clay discs that you can destroy. And they've got on them caricatures of Nancy Pelosi, President Obama, and Sarah Palin. And what you do, it says here, they're fun, fast, and effective way to relieve extreme political frustration. It's a regulation clay target that's only purpose is to be completely destroyed by your method of choice. Obama, Palin, Pelosi, they are all here, and the list keeps growing. Find the one that works best for you. And then they follow this up with be smart, blast safe. And I figured if they're putting up Be Smart, they really need to follow their own advice and take the site down.
Yeah. Wow. You know, you're putting me in the very uncomfortable position of defending Sarah Palin, but I don't even want to see her having to deal with this. Clay pigeons. These actually get shot.
They have videos of people, of their users, of people who are up for a contest to win $500 with the best YouTube, destroying these. And they're not very nice. I put them up on the site. And, you know, when Sarah Pack put the crosshair symbol map up a few years ago, they got, a lot of criticism. And to any kind of encouragement and profiting from violence is not the best idea.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Well, gosh, you know what? We actually have a minute left. If you want to help me lighten up, we can squeeze John Edwards in.
Okay, let's squeeze him in.
So to speak.
Yeah.
You got 40 seconds, girl.
Okay, Rielle Hunter says she's hoping to become pregnant before the Edwards trial in April, where he could be sentenced up to 30 years. So they're basically saying, let's try to have a baby by a father who has a life-threatening heart condition who may end up in jail for 30 years.
Oh, man, it's too bad she didn't catch Blago before he went in. She could have had twins. Kidding. Gotta laugh. Thank you so much.
Twins with big hair. And you're welcome.
Gotta laugh. Helps to edit the politicalcarnival.net. You'll find that link at our website, indeepradio.com. I'm Angie Carter. This is In Deep. This is In Deep. I'm Angie Coiro. In a just world, Tracy McMillan would be best known for her impressive new work, The American Way of Eating, undercover at Walmart, Applebee's, Farm Fields, and The Dinner Table. That's a book. But unfortunately, she came to most people's notice a week or two ago when Rush Limbaugh took notice of her. And first, let me welcome you, Tracy McMillan. It's nice to have you in the studio.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you were excoriated for being overeducated. You are the overeducated Tracy McMillan.
It's true. I was talking with friends. I said, well, you know, does he realize I only have a BA? And then I put myself through school because, you know, as somebody from a working class background, I sort of get the dig that, you know, people with multiple PhDs sometimes can be a bit removed from what reality is like for a lot of Americans. And I get that. But I was thinking, you know, I worked my butt off to put myself through school and I got a BA and I got a job and I do my job. I don't understand what the problem is with that, unless you think women aren't supposed to do any of those things. So
is it true that no publicity is bad publicity? Does it work out to
be
a plus?
In this case, I think that's definitely been my experience. You know, it's particularly once other media picked up on it, you know, just having my name out there, a lot more sales have done well. I mean, they've dropped back off now. They're still reasonable, but they really spiked for a few days. And
yeah,
that's always exciting for a first-time author to see.
Oh, great. Well, the American Way of Eating puts you in the undercover position of seeing how our food is processed, how it gets mm-hmm. to us, the people who work behind it. And it follows in a tradition that goes back to, you know, Jessica Mitford with the funerals and, mm-hmm. and the American Way of Death. And more recently, Barbara Ehrenreich with Nickeled and Dimed. Tell me what you wanted to add to all of that when you decided to put this book together.
Right. So journalistically, I really felt like I wanted to do a project that could engage with this growing interest in our food. And also that could get at some of the softer parts of that undercover experience. You know, I love Barbara Ehrenreich's book, and she engages mostly with her experience as a laborer, so in strict economic terms. And I wanted to take a little bit closer of a look at what those economic terms meant for the terms of someone's life, right? So in terms of, you know, the meals that I was preparing, and not just in the straight thing, well, cheaper food is cheaper, so that's what I'll buy. But, you know, as someone who's trying to be a little more creative and figure out how to do something where I'm eating well but able or not able to do it on those limited means, you know, really explore that. Mm-hmm. And I also really wanted to bring like a woman's voice into this undercover reporting. Like a lot, there have been other reporters that have gone and done, you know, sort of immersive projects with immigrant communities. They're usually men. And that's a very, very defining characteristic for your experience in a situation. And I really felt like, you know, so much of what we know of immigrant experience and of low-income experience comes from a male perspective. And I wanted to see, you know, just what it's like and what's different about your experience when you're female in those positions.
There were a couple ways that you didn't work to hide who you were. Although you were undercover, you didn't create an extravagant background for yourself. No. You didn't create a list of jobs that didn't really exist. And you know, on the second level, you can't hide the fact that you're a young, white, middle-class woman.
Right. You know, it's pretty difficult to convince anyone that I'm not white. Although it was very interesting when I was in the fields in California, you know, some of the workers would say, oh, so are you from Mexico? Are you from northern Mexico? You know, because I have very dark hair and very dark eyes. And so one guy was sort of hitting on me. He said, oh, but if you're not Mexican, then where did you get those eyes?
No, so, great
well,
line.
France, Germany, and actually, you know, my father was adopted, and we don't know his heritage precisely, but one of his parents is named Martinez and was from Southern California, and I have a sister who looks like me but very dark complected.
Maybe he was onto something.
Right, we would suspect that there might be some Mexican heritage in my bloodline, though certainly not my cultural heritage.
And in terms of how you represented yourself, you put down your real work history when you
interviewed.
Yeah,
anywhere that I was asked to do an application, I put down real jobs. I just only put down the ones that were most relevant generally. So those were usually older jobs, right? So those were the jobs I'd had from the time I was about 14 to 25 before I moved into white collar work. So I'd worked, you know, in restaurants, I'd worked a little bit in kitchens, you know, starting with Big Boy when I was doing salad bar prep, you know, when I was 16. I worked at a cider mill. I worked briefly at a grocery store. I worked, you know, at a number of kinds of jobs that make sense for someone applying to Walmart or someone applying to work at Applebee's. And then I, you know, would sort of use my less prestigious positions that were more recent, so copy editing and things like that. And, you know, and I didn't lie. I just said, you know, well, yeah, there's a 10-year gap and, you know, I've bounced around a lot. I've moved around. I've done a lot of different kinds of jobs. Been a pretty inconsistent work history, and I thought I'd put down the things that were, you know, sort of most relevant. So that's true insofar as it goes. Obviously, that 10-year period also included about 5 or 6 years of working as an editor at an investigative magazine and winning awards, and I did not put that down.
Yeah, I can see where that would blow the cover. When you talked about working in the fields, it's one thing for any of us, and when I say us, I mean middle-class people who probably haven't and will never work in fields. You go by there, you can't help but see these are people doing back-breaking work, very physical work, and you can imagine them doing it all day long. But it's another thing to read about what it means to work, especially in the heat. And I loved one of your verbal explosions about, you know, whose idea was this to start doing farming in the desert?
Right. You know? Well, you know, as someone who's from, you know, the eastern part of the country, you know, Michigan, I now can appreciate, is an incredibly lush and green place. And I hadn't really appreciated that before. You know, I live in Michigan or lived in Michigan until I was about 17. And then I moved to New York, which is, you know, a big city, but is amidst all these green rolling hills and these lush small farms. And, you know, farms are green places like out east.
And it's river soil that is naturally inclined to produce.
Right. And it's generally very fertile soil. You know, you can grow things there pretty easily, whereas the Central Valley is not a place that readily lends itself in its natural state to agriculture, right? You've got to do a lot of work to make it into the sort of breadbasket or fruit and vegetable basket that it is now. And that was shocking to me, right? Because even though I sort of knew, okay, in California it's industrial agriculture, I just thought that meant bigger green farms. I really didn't grasp that this is like a huge valley that may have or may not have fertile soil, but that has no water for most of the year, right? Because, you know, it's really strange to me to be walking through a peach orchard and literally every step you take, great clouds of dust puff out around your feet because the soil is that loose, it does not cohere. And it really, you know, those trees are only watered because there are these irrigation systems that come in and bring water to them. But, you know, the actual land itself is incredibly arid. And that was shocking to me.
Tracy McMillan is the author of The American Way of Eating. We're talking about that book, subtitle Undercover at Walmart, Applebee's, Farm Fields, and the Dinner Table. So there's certainly a book to be had just in terms of talking about the day-to-day life of the farm field workers. But in terms of what you uncovered about the American Way of Eating, what's the takeaway from your time in the fields?
Right. I mean, from my time in the fields, what I really took away was that farm wages aren't a very big part of what we pay at the store. You know, so I spent most of the time I was picking in the garlic fields. And so I was earning $1.60 for every 5-gallon bucket of garlic I could pick. That was about 25 pounds of garlic. And so when you do the math, that comes out to about 5 cents a pound. The same, one of the two companies that I ended up picking for, because the garlic I picked went to both Christopher Ranch and the garlic company. When I was working at Walmart, you know, the next year for the project, we were stocking garlic from the garlic company. It was $3.38 a pound, right? So my wages were not a very big part of what people were paying at the store, and you could certainly have increased, you know, what people were being charged to reflect, to sort of give me a raise without creating, you know, this huge spike in prices. Because anytime you talk to growers, they will say, oh, well, if you raise wages, then food's just going to be unaffordable. Mm-hmm. And that's not really what's driving the cost of food.
Well, since you bring up the money, it's interesting to note that both in the fields and at Applebee's, which we'll discuss later, you found some pretty creative accounting that ultimately ended up with you not being paid what you'd worked. For example, if there's a minimum wage to be attained, they just lie about how many hours you worked.
Right. That, for me, was also really shocking in terms of the field labor. So, you know, in doing the book, when I was out picking garlic, you get a card at the end of the day, like your sort of time card, and it says what hour you came in, what hour you left, and how many buckets you picked. So my first day, I had 10 buckets. Realistically, I'd picked about 7 or 8, and then other people had donated garlic to me, sort of out of pity mostly, I think. And, you know, at $1.60, that means I made $16 that day. And what would happen is somewhere between the field and the paycheck, somebody would say, oh, $16 divided by minimum wage, which is 8, is 2. And so instead of being paid for the 8 or 9 hours that I was in the field, my payroll check, so this very formal document, would say that I had been there for 2 hours. And then what happens is that accounting is what is shown to the people who are buying the garlic. So the garlic company and Christopher Ranch, when I talked to them, they said, well, all of our documents say that everyone made minimum wage. We don't know what to tell you. You know, as far as we're concerned, everybody was paid fairly. And when I said, well, I have a paycheck and, you know, time cards that don't match, do you want to see them? And they looked at them and they said, well, we don't know what to tell you. We don't have any record of you. You must be confused. There's probably, you know, there's a lot of people growing garlic down there and you probably were in the wrong field. And I said, well, I did write down the name from the label on the crate that was taken out of the field. And they said, well, we just don't know what to tell you.
What about that all-powerful farm workers union that's, you know, making everyone
right,
get their
that represents, I mean, like less than 5% of farm workers now, right?
Got it. Worth noting.
Yeah. And then in Applebee's, you know, that seemed much more like it was just such an informal industry. And there's a similar sort of disregard for regulation, but not to the same extent in farm work. Like in farm work, it's very obvious. They're like, nobody's going to complain. We don't have to comply with the laws because nobody's going to come and check either. And in terms of Applebee's, you know, I did get a sense that the company cares about, you know, making sure it doesn't run afoul of any laws and things like that. But because it's such an informal workplace, you know, people are like, oh, we'll fix that problem with your paycheck. And then they sort of forget and, you know, it's hard to say whether that's like a company policy or just somebody being a space cadet and not taking it very seriously.
We have less than 60 seconds to deliberate, but I do want to note the last thing that stuck in my mind about the farm field work was the integrity of the workers as to the product they were putting out despite their low pay and despite the unfair conditions. They cared about what the grapes looked like. They cared about what the garlic looked like.
Yeah, well, people care about doing a good job, right? I mean, I didn't find anybody to be particularly lazy, and certainly people were probably the least bitter in farm work out of any of the jobs, I think.
We're spending this whole hour with Tracy McMillan on her new book, The American Way of Eating, Undercover at Walmart, Applebee's, Farm Fields, and the Dinner Table. You can find all of this at indeepradio.com. Follow us on Twitter at indeepradio and on Facebook, In Deep with Angie Curro. You can always send your questions, comments, and guest suggestions to feedback at indeepradio.com. I'm Angie Curro.
Thank you. I can't live the way I did when I was an immortal kid. The things that I ingested were a crime. All that sugar, starch, and lard were making my aorta hard. And I'd prefer to live a long, long time. So on market day in our hometown, we rise and shine and head on down where the families and the farmers meet and thrive. Because we're taking nature's course, we get it fresh right from the source, where the bounty of the county comes alive. We'll have yellow fin potatoes and some fat heirloom tomatoes. I think the ones that look the weirdest taste the best. Well, I'll buy fish while you go look for English peas for Hugo. And then we'll shop together for the rest. And on market day in our hometown, we rise and shine and head on down where the families and the farmers meet and thrive. Because we're taking nature's course, we get it fresh right from the source, where the bounty of the county comes alive.
You are listening to In Deep. I'm Angie Coro. My guest is Tracy McMillan with her new book, The American Way of Eating. Visit our Facebook, by the way. We are at In Deep with Angie Coro. And you can catch this and all of our other interviews on our website, indeepradio.com. Tracy, we were talking about your work in the fields. You also put in time at Walmart and at Applebee's. Tell me what, in pursuit of the whole story of American food and the American way of eating, what were you pursuing in those two other locations?
Right. So going into Walmart and Applebee's were very right. I made that decision very clearly. I wanted to go to Walmart because Walmart's the largest grocer in the U.S. and the world. And it's actually right now the largest grocer in American history. So right now, Walmart sells about a quarter of our food nationwide. But it's really important to remember that people don't go grocery shopping nationwide, right? Like in New York, I'm not sort of judging the price of oranges against Los Angeles.
Right.
And so in, I think it's 29 metropolitan markets, Walmart represents more than 50% of the food market in areas. And then in smaller, you know, towns and things like that can often be, you know, much higher than that. And there's a lot of towns where Walmart's the only game in town when it comes to food.
That must have been an interesting contrast for you coming at this as you were ultimately in New York. You were originally Midwesterner, but as a New Yorker, and you talked about the first Brooklyn supermarket you had there. And even now, there aren't those massive parking lots. There aren't these huge warehouse stores. There's simply no room for that. So you can see where it would vary from a rural area to an urban area.
Right. It really changes. And it was really interesting to talk to city planning folks, both in New York and Chicago and a few other places that have been doing work to bring in supermarkets. And they talked about having this really weird experience convincing supermarket executives that they could make money in cities because they said, oh, well, there's no demand there, which sounds accurate until you think about that means that nobody eats, right? Like, there's no demand for supermarket. Well, that just means nobody wants to eat in those communities, which is, you know, not generally the case. But what ended up being the problem was that supermarkets really had their heyday in mid-20th century America, which is, you know, the big thing with suburbanization and those kinds of metrics. And so the way that supermarkets would decide if it was a good place to put a supermarket was median income, because suburbs had fairly high income levels and a fairly dispersed population. Whereas in a city, the way that you can measure it is not so much a higher income level, but by population density. So there might be, you know, instead of $50,000 a year, households might make $35,000 a year, but there's five times as many of them in the same space. Mm-hmm. And to have to convince supermarket executives that that could work for them, and also taking people on tours from supermarkets and saying, look at this neighborhood, and you know, talking to, I think it was Fran Spencer in Chicago, was telling me, yeah, well, we had some folks that, you know, just were very clearly very uncomfortable driving around an urban area, and they really felt like, you know, those people aren't our customers. And so that was really interesting to sort of get this handle on, like, how industry had sort of come up with this idea about what it was selling and to whom, and how that didn't meet some very basic market demand in urban areas.
So it sounds as though, even though they may have their professional research, which every large corporation has, they were coming up against their own attitudes about who they wanted in their stores as much as where they wanted their stores to be.
Yeah, that's true. And in the late 90s, early 2000s, some urban planning and marketing folks started to make the case, like, look, you can make money in urban areas, and that's part of why you've seen like a resurgence of sort of urban retail and things like that, and a lot of big national companies going into cities where, you know, 20 years ago they wouldn't have gone.
One of the things you mentioned in your book, it was a sentence that really stood out to me, and this goes to the issue of whether people in urban areas will eat better food if, in fact, they have access to it. And you said the key to getting people to eat better isn't that they should spend more money or even they should spend more time. It's making the actual cooking of a meal into an easy choice, the obvious answer. And I've never heard that put so plainly. So there is an issue of access. There is an issue of whether the supermarket is nearby and whether it's affordable. But there's also this whole perception we have about whether cooking a meal is going to be time efficient and money efficient, both.
Yeah, well, I think that there's been this really interesting move towards like fetishizing cooking a little bit, right? So the Food Network has all these shows, which I think in a lot of ways discourages people from cooking because it makes it seem like you have to be a television star, right, to know how to cook quickly and easily. And I know that particularly after I did this book project, you know, my relationship to cooking changed, and mostly it just became much more pragmatic. You know, now I'm like, it's so much more cost efficient for me to cook at home. It's so much healthier for me to cook at home. And I just have to remember that it's part of my daily life and it's part of my daily chore as a human. You know, I don't particularly love taking showers, yet I dedicate like 15, 20 minutes a day to doing that. You know, I can dedicate that much time to cooking too. And particularly, you know, I went and did this little sort of household experiment comparing Hamburger Helper from scratch to Hamburger Helper from the box. And I was really shocked that cooking it from scratch took me 1 minute more than making it from the box and was significantly cheaper. So I don't remember the exact numbers, but it was something that was like $6.25 to buy all the ingredients required to do it from the box and use the box. And it was $4.50 to do it from scratch. And so if you know how to cook and feel empowered to just say, okay, is it worth me spending five times as much, like this is going out to eat, is it worth me spending five times as much on a steak and potatoes to not have to do it myself and not have to do the dishes? Like that's a really empowering sort of decision to be able to make where I say, okay, well, you know, it cost me $4 for the ingredients and 20 minutes of my time. Am I really so tired today that I would rather just pay somebody $17 to do it for me?
But you did have, and I can't recall whether this was when you were working in the fields or when you were working at Applebee's, I recall reading that you did start to cook less for yourself. You did start to care less, but it just didn't seem to be a priority when you went home to start cooking.
Right. Well, particularly, I think my cooking was the worst when I was working on the night shift at Walmart, because that was something where I just, you know, it was the night shift, it was November, it was the holiday season, I was working in the baking aisle, and it was a really difficult job. And it's very physical. You know, we think about, you know, Walmart and these service sector jobs as being like these sort of mechanized jobs. And if you had asked me before I did this project, like how food got on the shelves in a store, I would have probably said, oh, there's got to be a robot or something. You know, but no, like in the middle of the night, what happens at a Walmart is that humans like are there with pallet jacks and these huge towering pallets of goods. So, I mean, I would have two construction pallets stacked 7 or 8 feet high with dry goods that would, you know, be sort of shrink wrapped together into a tower. And then, you know, I'm a 130-pound woman and I would have to sort of, you know, jack up the pallet jack and drag it down the aisle. It would be, you know, literally a half ton of dry goods, you know, drop it in the aisle and then move, you know, like a quarter ton of sugar and a quarter ton of flour and this much marshmallow and all of that. You know, it's a lot of very physical labor. And I would just be exhausted when I finished that work and I would go home. It would be, you know, 7:30 in the morning by the time I got home. I'd want to go to sleep. I'd get up at like 2 or 3 in the afternoon. And the last thing I wanted to do was cook. I was just exhausted. I just wanted to space out. And particularly because I didn't have money to buy takeout, it felt like much more of a chore. And I didn't enjoy cooking anymore.
Tracy McMillan's new book is actually in keeping with her longtime credentials. She writes about working and non-working poor. She looks into social mobility and economic inequality. She is a national award winner, including the James Aronson Award for Social Justice Journalism. And her book now out is The American Way of Eating. And that is what we're talking about. when you were at Walmart with whatever access you had to customers, you did emphasize when you went looking for jobs, I'm not really looking to do customer service. I don't want a lot of exposure to customers. But did you get a sense of what people were prioritizing by shopping at Walmart? Did they care about nutrition? Was it primarily cost? Was it primarily everything in one location? What was it?
Right. So what I could tell, I probably got a much better sense of this when I worked in the produce section, because I worked, you know, both on the night shift doing grocery, and then separately I worked in the produce section. So when I did produce, I was on the day shift, so I saw a lot more customers. And folks definitely were concerned about price, but quality was important to them too. And, you know, I would have people say, you know, what's going on with the raspberries here? Because the way that Walmart would sort of draw people is they'd say, oh, special on raspberries, you know, $1.50 for, you know, whatever the quarter pint is or whatever. But what they would do is they would put these raspberries, which are incredibly delicate fruits, like you basically can't even wash them before you send them to the store because they might disintegrate. They'd put them on these tables that were unrefrigerated and just stack them really high. And so every day we would throw out tons of these little things that were at the bottom and so had not been getting aerated and turned into little mold bombs, right? And so people were really concerned about, you know, that and wanted to know, how do I get good quality produce? And, you know, people want an affordable price, but they also don't want crap.
Well, it strikes me as almost counterintuitive for Walmart to do that, because they do have an investment in this food. They're not going to get their investment back unless it stays in shape to sell. So what would incline them to set up a display where they know they're going to lose their food?
Right. Well, there are sort of two things going on. One, and I write about this in the book, the produce manager under whom I worked was 20 years old and didn't know what he was doing. And it was just a terribly run produce department. And I have no idea if that's specific to that store or not. And I would suspect, like, they can't possibly run all their produce departments that poorly. But the other thing to remember is that Walmart isn't just a grocer. It doesn't just sell food. It sells all these other things in these super centers. And because Walmart is such a giant corporation and is selling so many different things, it can really play with its pricing cocktail, like, much more than anybody else. And so there's a degree to which Walmart can lose as much money on food as it wants, as long as it's making up other money in the rest of the store, right? So if it, you know, loses money on the produce section all the time, but it makes up for that in its private label processed foods, you know, its bottom line stays the same. So there's a degree to which Walmart doesn't have to provide high quality food or sell that much produce as long as the rest of the business is going really well.
It's one thing to see that in a Walmart. It's another thing to see that in a restaurant, a very popular restaurant. And yet almost everything you saw at Applebee's behind the scenes, even what you would consider to be the quote unquote fresh food, was frozen or prepackaged, pre-cut, plasticized. It's interesting that because food is their one and only investment, they still, it's not fresh. They're not going to risk a lot of that going bad.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, Applebee's is this kind of model where you see industrial food really just taking center stage and figuring out, okay, how do we streamline all of the costs as much as possible so that we can, and then put out like a really high volume and not have to pay people particularly high wages because they don't need that much skill necessarily to you know, do the work. And obviously, like, kitchen work is notoriously underpaid anyway. And I don't think the cooks at Applebee's were making that much less money than they would in a finer restaurant. But, you know, pretty much the only things that were cooked fresh, you know, like, we're still meats that were defrosted and then cooked. And I would feel fairly comfortable eating meats at Applebee's at this point. I would avoid salads generally because that stuff just comes in pre-chopped and who knows how old it is. So It might not be moldy, but I mean, there's a reason that the lettuce is not that fresh tasting. And then obviously the sides for me were sort of very complicated because, you know, the mashed potatoes are made from real potatoes, but they are mashed with something called garlic milk, which is this white liquid that comes in a plastic bag that's as a frozen block and then is defrosted and mashed in with these potatoes, which are steamed, but they're not washed. They're just sort of rinsed off quickly. So you have that, and then they're, you know, portioned out into plastic baggies and then nuked in the microwave to heat them back up. And that plastic often degrades into the food. So my job was actually as an expediter in the kitchen. So it was my job to sort of dump out the plastic baggies of broccoli that had been steamed in the microwave, plastic baggies of mashed potatoes, and often the bags would flake out onto the food a little bit. So you'd wipe off as much as you could, but often it would just sort of, you know, land on the food.
There was one moment in your book that was actually almost sad for me, because it's not uncommon for people in the restaurant industry, be they in front of the house or back of the house, they all hold extra jobs. It's right. 2-3 jobs per person is not rare. And you talked about one cook there who spoke with reverence of a restaurant that made its French onion soup by cooking the onions there, right, as though that were some Mount Olympus to be achieved. It's really sad.
Right. Well, I found it really interesting. The more that I talked with the cooks there, you know, those weren't guys that had no idea how to cook anything. It's just that they had found a decent job. And, you know, Applebee's, for all of its problems, right, is a corporation, which tends to mean like there's more of an opportunity for moving up in the workplace. You know, but a lot of the cooks I worked with, they knew how to cook stuff like at a higher level than they were. And they would sort of say, oh, this other place, like we cooked the soup from scratch, or, oh, this other place I worked at, we actually cooked the spaghetti fresh and then just pulled it out of the water when we were, you know, serving it. Whereas at Applebee's, right, that stuff would be cooked in the morning in a giant pot, portioned out into a plastic bag, and then just nuked in the plastic bag before service. And then, so, I mean, we had like a pesto Alfredo. And what that was is it was penne that had been cooked in the morning and was microwaved and then tossed with a styrofoam cup of Alfredo sauce that came in a plastic bag, right? And same thing with the pesto, was something that came in and just sort of all gets microwaved together and sent out. And, you know, for me, I felt like, you know, I can do that kind of cooking at home. I don't really feel like I want to pay people like this huge markup for that kind of food.
I'm not sitting here to slam Applebee's, but right, I have only eaten there once and it was the most god-awful experience. It was bad food. And I was stunned to see that it was, forgive me if I don't remember what was in the book or the materials that came with it, that this is the largest family-style sit-down restaurant in the country?
Yeah, Applebee's is the largest casual sit-down restaurant. So there are different categories of restaurants. And it's important to remember, right, restaurant industry is still dominated by independent restaurants. So the vast majority of restaurants in the U.S. are independently owned. Applebee's is still the largest single operator. So I think it's still less than 5% of all sales, but I thought that was really interesting. And it's also the largest internationally, right? So it's a place that has restaurants in, like, I think a few dozen other countries. And so I thought that was really interesting to explore sort of that universalization of that kind of food.
So what does that say about the American way of eating, that this is a vastly successful corporation where people get nuked and prepackaged food?
Right. Well, you know, I think it's that people aren't really going to Applebee's because they think the food is so great. They're going there because it's familiar, they know what they'll get, and because they just want to go somewhere easy and sit down and have someone take care of them for a night. And I don't begrudge anybody that. You know, I go out to Applebee's when I'm with my family in Michigan, and it's fine. Now that I know how to order off the menu, I usually am like, okay, you know, I'm just going to have like this burger, this catfish sandwich and French fries. If you stick to the basic diner type fare, I feel like I've generally had a good experience.
Well, in fact, you talked about the way that pre-prepared food is permeating, you know, even the upper echelons of restaurants. You made a reference to Thomas Keller using flash frozen French fries, which blew me away. Thomas Keller, for our listeners who don't know, is a respected high-end chef.
Yeah, so I just, you know, did a little bit of research trying to figure out, you know, well, do other restaurants do this? Like, how common is this? And there are some things that, you know, lots of chefs have just decided, you know, we can serve it something that is made and processed, and then we sort of dress it up, and it will taste just as good. And, you know, I'm not really against that entirely, particularly for something like French fries, but I thought it was really interesting because we think when we're going out to eat that we're paying someone to cook for us. And the degree to which we're getting someone to cook for us versus nuke something for us, I think that's important. That's an important piece of information to have.
Got another segment to go with Tracy McMillan. Her book is The American Way of Eating, Undercover at Walmart, Applebee's, Farm Fields, and The Dinner Table. We'll be talking a little more about the content of the book. And to some extent, the reception she's had for the book is almost as interesting as the book itself. So we'll be getting into that. You're listening to In Deep. I'm Angie Curro. You can follow us on Twitter at In Deep Radio. We'll be right back with Tracy McMillan. Talking to Tracy McMillan here on In Deep Radio. I'm Angie Curro. Her book is The American Way of Eating, Undercover at Walmart, Applebee's, Farm Fields, and the Dinner Table. We're talking during the break about the narratives around poor people and food. What poor people are willing to eat, what people who live in poverty, you know, what their preferences are, whether they have access to food. Some of that you found to be true, some of it you found to not be true.
Right. Well, obviously, you know, folks with limited income want convenience as much as anyone else, but, you know, I felt like I heard a lot of people often saying things along the lines of, well, you know, poor people, they just go to Walmart because they don't care. Or poor people, like, you know, of course they're eating fast food because it's so cheap. And actually, fast food's not that cheap to feed a whole family. And there's actually a study recently documenting that most fast food purchasing is done by middle-income families. And, you know, pretty much everyone I met that was of limited income, like, did really care about their meals and they did care about health. I've never had anybody say, you know what would be awesome? Diabetes. And I'm just going to start eating, like, crappy food because I want that. You know, and I felt like, you know, so there's got to be something more going on. And the more that I dug into this, the more that I really felt like, you know, we've just really failed at making it easy for folks to get to fresh, healthy food and to include it in their lives. And so maybe instead of sort of lecturing at people about what they should be eating, which, you know, we've certainly been doing at least since I was a kid, telling people to eat their vegetables, and folks don't really do that. Like, maybe we should start looking at other ways to, like, make that the easy choice for people instead of just assuming that it'll be easy for them.
I was interested in hearing your analysis of that, because when I interviewed the director of Food Inc., the documentary, he made the comparison that if you have your two kids in the car and you go through McDonald's and you order off the dollar menu, that you're going to feed everybody in the family for approximately the cost of two heads of broccoli. And that resonated with me. I thought that made sense. And it's interesting that, you know, you found studies that cite just the opposite.
Yeah, I mean, if you're straight off the dollar menu, maybe.
But who's going to restrict themselves to the dollar menu
right,
all the time?
But I feel like not that many people are actually making that kind of that sort of choice. Mm-hmm. And most families that I have talked to, they don't eat fast food that much. They'll do a mix of convenience foods, right? So they'll get pre-cut fruits and pre-cut. They will get pre-cut vegetables at the grocery store so they can nuke that. Or, you know, a lot of frozen foods, canned foods, that happens a lot. And so some very creative pairings, right, of, like, you get this kind of frozen food and then you mix it with some fresh food and trying to make that work. You know, so I haven't seen any sociological data showing that fast food is something that poor people eat. And mostly it's middle-income families doing that.
Which makes sense. The obesity epidemic is pretty much across class lines.
Right. Well, and I think that, you know, without there being any real proof of families doing that across the board, you know, I sort of think that's not giving low-income families very much credit for caring about their kids or their diets, right? And I think obviously some families probably do make those kinds of choices, and some folks are eating a lot of frozen pizza and things like that. But I don't think that's a straight cost analysis, right? That has to do with convenience and access and wages, right? I think wages are a really big part of this because that's basically a way to subsidize demand for, like, better food, right? Mm-hmm. And so if you're talking about why low-income families are making those decisions, it gets, I think it's much broader than it's easy to go through the dollar menu.
You know, one of the things I appreciated about reading your book was at one point you really tackled this polarity that we think about, that you were talking about the fetishizing of food, about this food network idea, but then you also talked about the grabbing everything fast food idea. And the fact is, we really don't exist in those two polarities. A lot of us exist more in what you just described, which is we do some convenience, we do some fresh foods. And if you present the cooking of food to be economical, healthy, et cetera, you have to start with dried beans and whole everything out of the bag. No one's going to take that much prep, or a small percentage of will take that much prep. Most of us exist between the two poles.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to meet people where they're at, right? And sort of say, okay, well, how are you making decisions about your food and why? And what keeps you from making more healthy decisions? Like, that was part of what I wanted to sort of explore in doing these jobs and working, you know, for these wages and living off of them, and sort of seeing what pressures came to bear on the way that I ate. You know, and I found it really difficult to continue eating really well, particularly eating lots of fruits and vegetables, given my income level. You know, I could still eat a lot of home-cooked stuff, but it was a lot of rice and beans, and that gets very drab after a while. And particularly if you don't know how to cook really well, I would also argue that, you know, if you can't cook really well and you don't have a lot of money, cooking, it doesn't make much sense, because you might screw it up, right, and end up with a bunch of inedible food that you just spent a bunch of money and time on. And that's why you're going to see people turning to convenience foods, because at least it's guaranteed that you'll have something, right, that you can eat. If you get the frozen bag meal from Walmart for $5 for two people, it might not be the best quality, but at least it's going to be edible, as opposed to if you ruin something and burn it and end up having to get takeout anyway.
Where are people learning? The people who do cook, where are they getting? We don't have home ec classes anymore.
Right. Well, we actually, interestingly, about the same share of kids take home ec as in the 50s. So it's about a quarter of students, although the gender balance of that has shifted. It used to be entirely female almost, and now it's more mixed. But, you know, we don't have any sort of – there's very little national metric analysis in terms of what people's cooking skills are. Like, there's really no social data on this. Like, do people know how to cook? What do they know how to cook? So what I was able to do is I just found some reports from cookbook editors talking about what they had to do. And it was very fascinating where, you know, in the 70s, they would just say, add two eggs. And then by the 80s, they were saying, crack two eggs into a bowl and beat them with a fork.
Lest they be added with the shells on.
Right. And keep, you know, sort of getting more and more detailed, because people weren't learning this. You know, and traditionally, folks have learned cooking from their families. But it's been really interesting, particularly in the wake of welfare reform. You know, families really have to work. There's not that much time that people can spend at home with their kids. Middle class women moving into the workforce in the 70s, like, didn't just change, you know, whether or not they were cooking, but it changed whether or not they had time to teach their kids how to cook. And particularly when you have limited time, right? Like, it's a pain in the butt to teach kids to cook. They're going to screw stuff up. You're going to end up with messes. And if you are a working mother just trying to get dinner on the table, you know, you're not going to have that much time to show your kid how to make gravy and do all these other things, right? And so, you know, it really came out of this thinking that, you know, there's a lot of ways that cooking could be a really great thing to have in public education, because it's an important skill for self-sufficiency.
Do you foresee a future where that kind of prioritizing of basic skills could happen again?
I don't know if that's going to happen. You know, one of the nice things about being a journalist making prescriptions is I don't have to be the one in charge of implementing them, right? I certainly know from my experience, you know, I started cooking when I was really young. And when we got to fractions in fourth grade, I was like, I already know this. I've been adding and subtracting, you know, tablespoons and teaspoons from each other for, you know, 3 years now. Like, I already know how to do this. And I think that, you know, it's that kind of hands-on learning that really cements skills for kids. And, you know, cooking can be chemistry and math and all this stuff. And if it's, you know, men and women both learning how to do that, you know, one of the things that I found really fascinating was that the biggest predictor of how much time a woman spends in the kitchen is not her work status, like full or part-time. It's not her income level. It's whether or not she has a partner.
Ooh.
So that's what sort of drives women into the kitchen, right? And I thought that was really fascinating.
She spends more time in the kitchen if she has a partner.
Yeah.
Well, there's an argument for living alone.
And I just thought, you know, it's really interesting to me that there's so much discussion. There's an increasing emphasis on cooking's really important, but it's mostly men making those arguments. And I find that really interesting, right, that we have a bunch of men talking about, like, we need to be cooking more, that's really important for health, which is totally true. As a woman, I take some umbrage with a bunch of men telling me to do that.
It's interesting that you put the two thoughts together. Yeah, that's not something you hear presented very often. Let's talk a little bit about the reception that you've had for the book so far.
Sure.
I alluded in the beginning of the conversation to Rush Limbaugh following up his criticism of Sandra Fluke with criticism of you for being overeducated. Let's call that the extreme pole of the reaction to you. But some of the rest of the reaction has been a little peculiar. You and I talked a little bit before we started our show about a reaction you got in the San Francisco Chronicle that seemed to be reviewing more than the book, seemed to be reviewing the very concept of you doing this. And there are some other folks who made assumptions about you as a person, you know, deigning to go down with little people, you know, minimizing your standards of life to do this undercover fakery. What are the assumptions underlying that you've been discovering?
Right. Well, it's been really interesting for me because one of the reasons I wanted to go and do the book was because I felt like so much of the discussion around food didn't take into account how most of America lives, right? It was something that made a lot of sense for upper income families, but didn't make sense for working parents. And so, you know, I sort of wanted to go and like prove the foodies wrong and sort of like engage with all this stuff, right? Which is funny, but is also true. And so there's a degree to which I identify with these concerns around elitism. And so I was particularly shocked to sort of be getting those same charges levied against myself. And even the Rush Limbaugh stuff, you know, talking about me as a single white woman who's overeducated, you know, that's all code for elite in a lot of ways too. And so to get, you know, this reaction that I'm some sort of elitist, you know, I think generally speaking, probably means they haven't read all of the book, right? Because I go into my background and my roots pretty clearly in the introduction and talk about, you know, that I grew up in a working class family with a lot of struggles. And certainly we didn't have a lot of money. And that's part of why I wanted to do the book. So it's just really interesting and sort of gets at like this idea that, well, if you care about food, you must be an elite person and you must be this sort of high-end fancy person. And the whole point of the book is that, you know, most Americans already care about their food and we need to be talking with those people, you know, and to just be really fair, you know, most people who are working at Walmart are not going to be able to get the kind of audience that I can get as a journalist to talk about their lives, right? And so while the book chronicles my experience doing those jobs, like I'm there as a ruse to get people to pay attention to what's happening with my coworkers and the folks that, you know, don't have the luxury of being able to go to like a white collar job at the end of the day.
There's a certain symmetry to the assumptions that are around your creating the book and the assumptions that you examined in the book. If poor people don't care about the food they're feeding their children, which is something you exploded, it makes sense that only the elite would go down and teach the poor people to care. So right. You would have to be elite by definition. You know, that matches the view of the universe.
Right. Well, most of the people who are charging me with being elite are making a heck of a lot more money than I am every year and probably are pretty far up the American income scale. So it's interesting to have folks, you know, who are winning lots of big fancy food awards and make very comfortable livings for themselves, are writing about food, sort of call me out for being an elitist when, you know, I just closed my food stamp case in January. You know, I drive a 1994 Ford Escort. Like, I have an education that I worked my butt off to get, but it, you know, I live a pretty simple life. I'm actually, you know, not that far removed, in fact, from the places that I was reporting from, particularly in terms of economics.
It's interesting to hear this reaction, too, in the fact that our class distinctions in America are, to my understanding, stronger than they have been in decades.
Yeah.
We really have the increasing divide between the haves and the have-nots. Am I going too far afield to attach that to some of the criticism you've gotten?
Well, I think there is a growing class consciousness in the U.S., which has been really interesting because part of the reason that I started writing about food was that what I really wanted to do probably 5-7 years ago as a reporter is I wanted to write about poverty and welfare, and that's what I found really interesting and had a passion for. But people didn't want to talk about it, and I found that it was really difficult because I would have to get people to talk about welfare and poverty. I would have to get them to admit that not everyone in America was middle class. And like 7 years ago, that was a really difficult thing to get people to accept because it sort of had to explode their notion of America. And because of the things that have happened with the economy and the widening income gap, you know, there's not that same barrier. Mm-hmm. So there's a degree to which I'm sort of like, well, if I'd known people would talk about class by 2012, like I didn't have to go do the food thing. You know, so it's been really interesting to see how that's moved forward.
Do you think if you wrote this book 10 years ago, you would have found different people working at Walmart, different people shopping at Walmart or eating at Applebee's?
I think in terms of working at Walmart, possibly the economy hadn't quite tanked as much, although I was in Michigan and the economy there has been having a very difficult time for, you know, a very long time. And particularly when I was working on the night shift, I realized, you know, most of the people I was working with had worked there for 7 years, for 10 years, for 12, 15 years. You know, these are folks who in an earlier generation would have been the ones working at a factory making a union wage and supporting their families. You know, now, you know, they go and they work at Walmart for 7 years and they eke their way up to $11 an hour.
What's the most surprising takeaway for the book from you, the thing that really rocked you?
Yeah, I probably was most surprised to find how unregulated farm labor was for in terms of wage and hours. You know, because I was, you know, I was making $2 to $4 an hour in this very formal, systemic way. And if you had asked me before I went out there what I was going to find, I would have said, well, it's going to be really hard work, probably making about minimum wage. And to find that that really was not in place for me was really shocking. And particularly also to see sort of just how much less mobility there is for American families now, that was, you know, I sort of knew that, but I was really shocked. Like working at Walmart, it was really shocking for me to see people saying, you know, well, Walmart, I can move up in the company here and I can sort of get up to $10 or $12 an hour. And, you know, the benefits aren't that great, but well, I'll get a lifetime discount card when I get to 15 years. And that kind of broke my heart, you know, to hear that that was sort of the best that folks felt like they could aspire to. Because, you know, I was raised thinking that, you know, America's this land of opportunity and we can all move up. And to find folks that, you know, really had lost that hope, like that was really difficult for me.
And yet you found some of the people who worked there who were glad they weren't unionized because that would be more money out of their check.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, that makes sense for a single mom who doesn't necessarily see the benefit in a union because she doesn't think the union's going to be able to get her higher wages and better health care, right? I could see why you would think not. And Walmart also does a very sophisticated job in its orientation of sort of indicating that it doesn't think unions are going to do very much for workers. So I think that, you know, if you're someone that, you know, hasn't had a lot of conversations about that before and you see that video, it makes a lot of sense to just want to keep those dues in your check as opposed to sort of building a little more collective power so that you can ask for more from Walmart. But there's this great new campaign called Making Change at Walmart where a bunch of Walmart workers are actually organizing themselves, not in a formal union, but trying to make those into better jobs for themselves.
Is there anyone that you worked with in the book that you're in touch with now and they see what you're doing and you've gotten reaction from them?
So I'm still in touch with the farm worker families. So the folks that I lived with and worked with in the garlic fields in Salinas and also in the Central Valley and grapes. I haven't had time to go visit them with copies of the book yet, but I've been in touch with them over time. And, you know, we have sort of a nice friendship at this point.
What's their reaction to your having done this?
They're pretty nonplussed. One family is just sort of like, okay, can you help us with our immigration status? And I keep having to sort of explain that, you know, even though I have, you know, more privilege in our society than they do, I don't have that kind of pull.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other, another family is really hopeful that it'll help change conditions in the fields for them. And so, you know, we'll see what the fallout is from the book.
Are you hopeful?
I'm optimistic. The labor commissioner here in California comes out of a garment worker background, and so she's very interested in dealing with farm labor contracting and wage and hour complaints, so that you might see some change. And then under Solis, like the labor department's been doing more stuff around ag labor.
I thank you so much. This has been a great, great conversation.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tracy McMillan has been in the studio with her book, The American Way of Eating, Undercover at Walmart, Applebee's, Farm Fields, and The Dinner Table. And that's a wrap for In Deep Radio this week. You can find us online at indeepradio.com, on Facebook as In Deep with Angie Cuero. Our executive producer is Gordon Whiting. Matt Fiddler's our engineer. Our theme is by Big Troubles. That guy in the background, David Gans, is providing our closing music. Visit us online at indeep.com for web-only extra this week from Cindy Myers and more. And we'll be back next week to once again go In Deep. I'm Angie Cuero.
Before it gets better, it's gonna get worse. Before it gets better.
Thanks for tuning in this week to In Deep, which is a production of Live from the Left Coast. You can get more information on the show and our company at lftlc.com. Live from the Left Coast. While you're there, you can become a member and support our work. We have a separate website for the show that is indeep.org. If you have any questions or feedback, there's a contact button right there, indeep.org. We are developing a recurring series on mental health issues in our country, especially in this economy, and you're a big part of that. We'd like your topic suggestions, your stories, and your questions. Send them in via our website, the contact button at indeep.org. Join us again this time next week for two more hours of in-depth conversation. I'm Angie Coiro. Thanks, and we will see you then. You are listening to WPWC, 1480 AM, Dumfries, Virginia. We Act Radio, home of Washington's progressive working community.